for the first time. I get to welcome Diane Frank to Many Rivers Books and Tea. She has written a book with a beautiful cover, and I've just discovered she actually has other poetry books with beautiful covers as well. And that right there sets her apart from many of the authors who come to speak here at Many Rivers, because honestly, there's a lot of books that have bad covers in this store. And I actually appreciate someone. I assume that you've had input into the publisher.
Absolutely. The publisher of my novels and always asked me for my input. He came up with the cover for Blackberries in the Dream House.
Okay.
But
well, that's a good cover too.
But they didn't. I didn't like what they came up with. So I said, well, how about The Kiss?
And got it. Well, the saying is that you cannot judge a book by its cover, and yet your books fly in the face of that wisdom. So I am delighted to welcome Diane Frank to Many Rivers Books and Tea, and I hope you will join me in welcoming her.
I'm really delighted to be here. I want to thank each and every one of you for coming. And before I talk about Yoga of the Impossible, I want to share some really outrageous good news. About 5 weeks ago, I had an anthology of poetry published called River of Earth and Sky, Poems for the 21st Century. And I asked more than 100 poets, if you could only be remembered by a handful of poems, what would they be? And they sent their poems, and then I chose which ones really spoke to me, body, mind, heart, and soul. And I also mixed very famous poets with the grassroots. There are some people where that book is the first publication ever for them. And it's been on the bestseller list for 5 weeks.
Wow.
Like poetry. I mean, just like maybe the earth is changing. I don't know. It's an outrageous thing. And something I'll tell you, since you're holding a copy of my first novel, is that it's a future incarnation of the same soul. So, Blackberries in the Dream House is a forbidden love story of a geisha and a Buddhist monk. Came in deja vu, and then just I worked it, because that's what I do. So, first of all, I want to let you know a few things that Yoga of the Impossible is a novel. It's not a book about yoga. So it's a book with a very strong spiritual underpinning, which I will talk about before I read anything from it. It could be a how-to manual about how to live your life as an art form, or how to create a deeply spiritual relationship in a world where people have forgotten the secrets of love for the most part. But it's not a how-to yoga book. In my novel, the narrator, who is a gypsy sculptor named Katerina, sees everything through the lens of the Yoga of the Impossible, which is a path of getting enlightened by working with opposites and contradictions. You know, kind of sounds like life. And then since I'm in a room full of probably very spiritual people, you're probably curious about what the Yoga of the Impossible is. And along with seeking enlightenment through opposites and contradictions, it's a path of quirky wisdom that doesn't involve running away from the world. It's like if you've been doing some kind of spiritual practice and you're really happy with your practice, but still something about your life doesn't make sense, it's a good thing to work with. And because it's a way of using the mysteries in your life, the riddles, as a path to get enlightened. And according to the Yoga of the Impossible, if you explore any opposite or contradiction to its edges and beyond, there will be something larger that unites it. And if you explore every opposite and contradiction in your life beyond its edges to that something larger, you could get enlightened. So, and you could also have a lot of fun in the process. You know, it's kind of using the things that drive you nuts as a way to move forward, because there are things about this planet that drive everyone nuts. So yoga of the impossible has its sources in Zen Buddhism, especially in the koans, and also in Vedic philosophy, the principle of the unification of opposites. So anyway, I want to tell you how this book came into being too, because I never planned to write a novel. I'm trained as a poet, but three novels have come to me. There's a new one in process. They always land on Fridays for some reason. And while I was on my tour with Blackberries in the Dream House, I danced my way across the United States. I was hosted by people in the dance gypsy community. I never paid for a motel. I never rented a car. I would just let people know I was coming. And this part of this book, a good part of this book, takes place in the dance gypsy community. And at that time, I was single. I had a lot of love in my heart, and I needed a way to express it. So somehow, I'm very late bloomer. I needed to find a way to express my truth and started writing this book. And I knew that I had a soulmate, even though there was no visible sign, and even though my friends thought it would take an act of God. I think maybe there's something divine at work when any soulmates connect. So about the story, just a little overview of the story. Take an American geisha who knows everything that the geishas know about love. Put her in a society where the secrets of love have been forgotten and ask her to find her way. Already you've got a setup for Yoga of the Impossible. The story is told through the soul of a sculptor who lives her life like a contemporary Aphrodite. And as you read, you'll meet a whole tribe of late-blooming artists looking for love on a crooked path, a lot of us. For some people, love comes easy. For others, it takes a long time and a lot of learning has to happen first. And Yoga of the Impossible is populated by musicians, dancers, sculptors, radio talk show hosts, beta fish, and mermaids. As you read, pay attention to the mermaid. That'll kind of lead you into the third book I'm writing. So I begin with Katerina, the sculptor, speaking as an adult, and then I go back and tell her story. So I will read that to you. The novel actually begins with a poem by Rumi. Between my love and my heart, things were happening which slowly, slowly made me recall everything. You arouse me with your touch, although I can't see your hands. You have kissed me with tenderness, although I haven't seen your lips. You are hidden from me. Part one is swimming back from the light. Chapter one. His emotions were slippery, like an avocado. It rained between conversations. We were in a cafe on Judah close to the beach, where sand dollars pile up after the low tide. We sat by the window, waiting for breakfast, avocados and eggs, before a journey into the underworld. When the rain stopped, the light turned green at the corner, reflecting on the puddled streetcar tracks. "I'll be keeping the light on inside for you," he said. I told him, "I'll remember that," whispering to myself, "table crumbs," wanting to slide my hands inside his shirt. He paid for my omelet, which is a signal in this part of the country. He said he'd been painting all morning and ranted about what the fumes do to your nose. I could see it. Green paint on the hairs inside his nostrils. On Friday night, he kissed me on the street, gave the half-Japanese man $2 to buy himself a beer and go away. We talked about how strippers in West Palm Beach are like the geishas in Kyoto. He told me men like to give their power to these women and let the woman be in charge. I told him about the no actor in Kyoto who thought I was a geisha. He took me out for tea late at night, which is expensive, because he needed to tell his secrets to a stranger, someone he'd never see again. American men don't tell you what they mean. They give signals. They think about seducing you in airplanes, but pretend they don't care. They don't tell you the truth until you are gone. Later that night, we walked on the beach. I found a slice of a nautilus shell, the fractal spiraling to the edge of my emotions. We stepped over a pile of sand dollar fossils, etched orbits of the pentagram pressed to stone between sand. I wanted to put my nose against his skin, then my lips. I remember the night in San Francisco when we went to Ebisu for sushi and got a little drunk on sake. That was my first signal. The wind was blowing fog from the Pacific Ocean, swirling around a telephone booth in the inner sunset. We tangled around each other on the streetcar and loved each other for hours that night. His plane leaves at 6 o'clock in the morning. I let the hug he gives me imprint like oak leaves, bamboo over a koi pond, his eyes, eggshell blue, full of messages. My emotions, spider webs on leaves tearing apart. And what does it mean to have a man inside you? I ask like Scheherazade. I tell him stories. So, going back in time now, very early in the novel, two very young teens face a trauma together. One is 12, one is 14. And this again, Katerina speaking as a 12-year-old. Christopher lived down the street from me. A few days after we moved from Manhattan to our new home in Saddle River, I adopted him as my older brother. Our families went on vacations together every summer. Christopher was really good at math and an amazing artist. He could draw anything, and it looked like the person, the cat, or the tree. From the time I was 8 years old, he gave me drawing lessons. After school, he walked me home and helped me with my math homework. As the youngest of six boys, Christopher enjoyed having a little sister, even if she lived in another house. When I was 12 years old and Christopher was 14, our families went on vacation to Lake Hopatcong. Two summers ago, we went out on the lake in a rowboat, but this year his brothers brought a beautiful red canoe. From the dock, Christopher showed me how to use the paddle with different strokes to make the canoe go forward, backward, and turn. Then my mother let him take me out on the lake. It started as a perfect day, sky blue as a robin's shell, with puffs of clouds like mashed potatoes or floating boats. The canoe so red and beautiful. I loved paddling with Christopher over the water, rippled with the reflection of the trees and the sky. A group of bigger boys in a silver canoe paddled up to us and started teasing Christopher. He was a little bit smaller than some of the other boys from his school, and these boys weren't in his group of friends. He tried to ignore them at first, but they wouldn't go away. They teased him about having a girlfriend, which was ridiculous. I wasn't old enough for that yet, and he was like a brother. Then they called out, "It's war," and started heading for our canoe to ram it. Christopher did his best to defend the boat. He yelled out, "Hey, she's younger than you. Leave her alone." We paddled as fast as we could toward the shore, but the boys were older and stronger. They came close to us and started ramming the canoe. Christopher took his paddle to try and push them away, but he leaned over too far and the canoe turned over. What happened after that is confusing to me. I knew how to swim, but one of the paddles hit me on the head. I must have blacked out and started going down. Later, Christopher told me he went down after me, but he couldn't find me in the water. It was too green and muddy.
I saw a tunnel inside the water. I left my body and started walking through, or maybe floating. In the distance beyond the tunnel, I saw a light, almost like a skylight inside a geodesic dome filled with music. There was a radiance inside the light. I felt this as a steady stream of love. I flew into the light and was gently embraced. I heard music that felt like memory and saw my future inside a field of calla lilies. The calla lilies were lit up from inside as if by sunlight. I felt God as a steady flow of love and light. Then I felt gentle hands pulling me back to a world I knew. Inside the tunnel, Christopher took my hand, and we started swimming back from the light. Swimming underwater, swimming through light, swimming through green waves toward the world. There's an animal part of us that needs to breathe, and the air came rushing. I floated through my skin and found myself back inside my body. Somehow, we were on the earth again. When I opened my eyes, we were both on the shore of Lake Hepatcong, surrounded by our families and a crowd of strangers. My mother was crying. She was holding me, stroking my face. I returned to a world where everything was sparkling, but I felt different in a way I couldn't explain. Christopher was on the ground next to me. Our eyes met inside the silence. So now you know why I'm in a metaphysical bookstore instead of somewhere else. But, you know, anyway, so where do you go from there? Yeah, you know, I have a really intuitive writing process. I don't plan things out in advance. My question is, what comes next? Not, you know, this, let's plan the whole thing out and then use the outline. So where do you go from here? This is what came. In the language of the birds. Christopher and I spent a lot of time together that summer. We had shared an experience that other people couldn't understand, at least not the people we knew. We walked in the woods, hiked in the mountains, and rode bicycles to deserted places. Christopher told me when he was in the light, he saw his life like a movie. There was a being of light who looked like a bird or an angel, and she watched the movie with me. We could communicate by telepathy. What surprised me most was so many things that felt wrong to me, with my brothers, my friends, and at school, were actually right. I could see that everything was really the way it was supposed to be, even if it didn't feel that way at the time. These were words that would never leave me. He let me know, "I tried to rescue you, but I couldn't find you. It was too dark and muddy at the bottom of the lake." The story my mother told me was the lifeguards pulled us out. When we went under, we were close enough to shore. That summer, I often dreamed about Christopher, the same dream, over and over. We are in a water tunnel, swimming towards the light. Christopher takes my hand, and we both swim free. That summer, my mother looked at me in a different way. I could see it in her eyes and hear it in her snake charmer music. One night, she cooked a special meal for the lifeguards and invited Christopher. As a gift, she gave them tickets to the New York Philharmonic. Christopher and I were quiet. We didn't know what to say. After dinner, we played music for them, selections my mother chose by Vivaldi, Telemann, and Bach. I think my mother wanted to show them something about the lives they had saved. I played flute and put my feelings into the music, but what Christopher and I liked best that summer was walking in the woods and listening to the voices of the birds. The birds reminded me of angels, and we could communicate with them by telepathy. We spoke the language of the birds, a private symphony of wood trails, silence, and bird sounds. Christopher and I lived close to nature in the woods of Stokes State Forest, High Point, and the Delaware Water Gap. We camped on Long Beach Island, walking early in the morning on the isolated seacoast. Christopher was my friend, my teacher, my guide. He felt that in solitude, one absorbs the personality of nature. We both chose to live inspired by Thoreau and the ideal of the sannyasi from India, deliberately alone in the classroom of nature. Being with Christopher did not diminish the feeling of being alone. It felt like hiking with a soul companion inside the music of my own soul. At times, Christopher would disappear for days. His grandmother sensed his need for solitude and asked him to be caretaker of the family's summer house on an Appalachian mountain slope in eastern Pennsylvania. While the rest of the family sailed her boat to Key West, he stayed alone in a cabin over 100 years old, close to a small lake. It was very isolated. Christopher cooked on an old wood stove, cut the lawn with a scythe, walked in the woods for hours, and watched the sunset over the mountains. Then he'd write in his journal or watch foxes and deer lurking around the edges of the woods. The shelves of the cabin were full of books, literary classics, the Bhagavad Gita, Whitman, Thoreau, Emerson, Annie Dillard, Mary Oliver, and a whole shelf of nature guides with illustrations of wildflowers, trees, stones, shells, and birds. Christopher discovered three illustrated albums of bird songs and played them over and over on the old phonograph until he had each call memorized. One afternoon, he watched a falcon fall out of the sky like an arrow, diving on some poor, unsuspecting chipmunk. Later that day, he read in the Bhagavad Gita about the cycle of life, death, and rebirth. Everything in the world was mysterious and filled with light. In her quiet way, his grandmother was an inspiring mentor to both of us. She was a real-life Demeter who loved birds, animals, growing things, and getting her hands dirty. After she returned from Key West, she came by my house in her old Pontiac station wagon, and after a chatty tea with my parents, drove me to her cabin. The next morning, she taught us how to attract chickadees with a dry whistling. She showed me how to weave on the hand loom in her cabin's loft. On the side of the mountain, we sat in silence, listening to the birds. She'd identify every one of them by their songs, which is how I learned their language. What I most remember about that summer is encrypted in the language of the birds. And I'm going to read the chapter where Katerina is introduced to the yoga of the impossible. I have two chapters called Yoga of the Impossible. One, you know, while she's a university student, and one many years later in her life.
Which one is this?
This is the early one, where she's just meeting it. So they're at Cornell University. I didn't go to Cornell. I didn't want people to say that I was writing a memoir, so I said it at a university that I visited but did not attend. And then in the second part of the novel, I actually have Katerina meet me in Iowa, you know, a poet who plays the cello. I just, you know, you have to throw people off a little bit. So here, chapter 14, Yoga of the Impossible. I entered my senior year of college with a new knowledge. I felt quietly confident but intensely vulnerable. From the center of this mystery, I saw everything in a deeper way. In the mirrors of the ballet studio where I danced, I saw my body transforming into a woman, filled with secrets I hadn't known before. When I worked in clay, I found a powerful new expression in my hands. I sculpted women with their heads thrown back in ecstasy, lovers in passionate embrace, goddesses with orchids in the center of the holy place. My hands were in an altered state of consciousness. One night, at a dorm room gathering with a friend who had painted her walls like a Tibetan temple, I heard about an honor seminar called Selected Topics in Contemporary Mysticism. That was where my friend informed me she got the idea for the Temple of Sacred Art we were sitting in. During her summer vacation, she had studied Tibetan Tonka painting with exiled Tibetan monks in Nepal, and sacred art was now the center of her spiritual practice. In a prayer circle around her walls, she had painted more than 100 Buddhas. To add a contemporary touch, she accented their auras with fluorescent brush strokes so that under a black light they glowed in the dark. I had been searching for something new and obscure to study during my final semester. Clearly, this was it. The professor was a Tibetan monk and a practicing shaman, having recently returned to New York after a sabbatical in Nepal. His course was so popular that every seat was taken and the aisles were filled with people sitting on the stairs. First, we read selections from the Zohar to explore the cosmological structure of the Kabbalah. After that, we read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, watching for parallels between Tibetan Buddhism and Kabbalah. Toward the end of the semester, he introduced us to an obscure spiritual discipline from India called the Yoga of the Impossible. It was a way of getting enlightened by exploring paradoxes and contradictions. Every contradiction, our shaman professor explained, has an underlying unity that pervades it, and every paradox is contained by a consciousness large enough to solve the riddle. If you follow a contradiction to its edges without resisting the mystery, you will break through to something larger. If you follow every contradiction until it reveals its mystery, you will become enlightened. This was a larger idea than I could sculpt. Even Jonathan, who was usually the one to share radical ideas with me, was fascinated. We talked for hours about the yoga of the impossible, walked with it, breathed it, ate it, drank it, lit candles over it, made love to the paradox. I woke up dreaming about contradictions and filled a sketchbook with paradoxes circling yin-yang signs. Do you want to have any questions before I've got a little more of the book that I want to share with you, but questions, comments? Okay, I'll go on.
Go on.
Okay.
So
during the second part of the novel, Katerina becomes a dance gypsy. This is very much a metaphysical love story, and as a dance, in the beginning, she's as a university student with her first boyfriend, she takes trips all over the United States and Canada, having these wonderful adventures along the way, you know, a quest to make every moment holy, to live her life as an art form. And then In the Midwest, a number of years later, she finds out about contra dancing and joins the Dance Gypsy community. So how many people here have been to a contra dance ever? Okay, so I'm going to read the... I wrote a chapter about contra dancing to explain it to people that had never done it before, and at the same time, I wanted to entertain the people that had, so... So this is called Circles and Stars on the Dance Floor. There is, by the way, contra dancing in Santa Rosa, Sebastopol, San Rafael. It's all over the place. It's a great way to have community. It's a great way to meet people, friendship, community. Some people meet their partners there that are more than dance partners. It's just, you know, some people just go there to dance. One of my friends has a T-shirt that says, I dance, I flirt, I sweat, I leave. So it doesn't, you know, people have their different relationships with it. So, Circles and Stars on the Dance Floor. Contra dancing is a very friendly, community-based form of American folk dancing. One of the great things about contra is that once you get into a dance, the patterns take you to all the dancers on the floor. Men and women are equally free to ask each other to dance. After you've done a few dances, it becomes very easy to ask other people to dance because you've already danced with them. So in addition to having a lot of fun, Contra is a flirtatious, playful venue for meeting people. I'm always a bit unsure what to say when someone who is completely unfamiliar with Contra dancing asks me to describe it. A physical description of the moves and figures doesn't convey the feeling of joy it brings. For a newcomer, I like to say that it is a highly accessible form of very social dancing, which almost anyone can learn quickly and easily. It's a traditional community dance in which dancers stand across from their partners in long lines. Most people change partners every dance, so you don't need to come with a partner. There's always live music featuring fiddle tunes, along with a mix of guitar, banjo, stand-up bass, piano, and anything else you'd like to throw into the soup. Each Contra band has its distinctive flavor and style, with names like Nightingale, Wild Asparagus, Lift Ticket, Uncle Gizmo, The Hillbillies from Mars, Air Dance, Flapjack, Stringfire, The Groovemongers, Notorious, and the Latter Day Lizards, who add saxophone, penny whistle, and flute to otherwise traditional instruments. The dances have names like Amy's Harmonium, Pigtown Petronella, Breakup, Breakdown, The Enchanted Forest, Flying Flamingos, Shame on Shane, Chuck the Budgie, and Flirting with Love Again.
Do you have any water here? Mm-hmm. With all the incense, I'm feeling a little bit here. I should have taken care of that in advance, but...
I like Latter Day Lizards. That's good.
They're fun. They're outrageous. They have saxophones and penny whistles, and they kind of mix a jazzy style into it. Stringfire is local, so you can hear them around here.
Thank
you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I will continue. Each dance consists of simple figures like those in square dancing, such as circle left, right hand star, forward and back, do-si-do, and of course, swing your partner. But unlike square dancing, you dance with a whole succession of people as you work your way up and down a line of couples. Each dance sequence exactly fits the length of one fiddle tune. Then you repeat the movements with the next couple in line until you have danced with everyone. And here's the best part, you get to hold a different person of the opposite gender in your arms every 30 seconds, or someone of the same gender, if that is your preference. A caller teaches each dance in a walkthrough, then prompts each figure once the music starts. A typical dance evening also includes a few couple dances, such as a polka, two or three waltzes, and a Scandinavian dance called the hambo. I should probably mention that changing partners without commitment after each dance is attractive to many single people. At the same time, the ability to have a dozen different dance partners in an evening creates a sense of community. But really, defining Contra dancing is elusive and difficult. A bit like describing making love. Too few words and you rob the activity of its value and meaning. Too many words and you risk smothering the life out of it with distracting details. One popular t-shirt from New England reads, Contra dancing, the most fun you can have with your clothes on. So that's a little bit of an introduction to that chapter. And One of the things that happens in the dance gypsy community, there are people that just go from dance to dance every few weeks. There are these gatherings. In the Midwest, the definition of a dance gypsy is somebody who will drive for more hours than the dance, than the length of the dance. So you just get a whole bunch of people in a car or a van. You might go 5 or 6 hours to Chicago or Indiana, you might Knoxville, Lexington Dance Trance. And a couple of chapters take place at Pigtown Fling, which is in Cincinnati. The novel sort of turns during a dance weekend in Lexington called the Dance Trance. And what happens is that you arrive, you walk into a gym, there's a band on the stage, there's a canopy of glittering lights, and there's about 220 dance gypsies who arrive during the weekend. And it's a real community because you get to see these people every few weeks. So this is, I mean, I grew up on the East Coast, very close to New York. I came of age in San Francisco. I had a teaching job in the Midwest for 16 years and in Iowa, and without the dance gypsy community, I would have gone nuts. And it's something I talk about in this book. In the Bay Area, you can say anything you want. You can be anything you want. It doesn't matter. What is your race, your religion, your sexual orientation? You can just be yourself. There's tremendous freedom here. It's not like that in the Midwest. You know, you say anything mildly sexual or unusual, and you can sort of, people look at you like, huh? And I was pretty sure that a lot of the heterosexuals were in the closet, and like, I can't imagine what it would be like to be gay there. It was just, and that the women actually were a little more out than the men, so it's kind of interesting. But anyhow, so I want to just read a little bit from the dance trance. This is just going to be a paragraph that, on the gym floor of the dance trance, I saw people looking for love, people looking only to dance, and people searching for casual encounters. I saw dance gypsies gathered to commune with their friends and share 3 days of joy, then go their separate ways until the next reunion. I saw couples who enjoyed community and lonely souls casting the net of their dreams, hoping to land the big one. People flew out of their ordinary lives and dressed like butterflies. Above us, a canopy of delicate colored lights sparkled the evening, whirling dreams stretched to the wall. Love was a gypsy moth, a weave of desire and fear. Balance and swing, apart, together. And a few other things about the book is there are two grandmothers in the book. They're both wise women. They really do a lot for Christopher and Katerina when they're younger, really letting them in on the mysteries, the secrets. A lot of the plants, flowers, birds in this book are endangered species. In many ways, this book is a prayer for this planet to stay alive and stay in a good place. And since there's a lot of encouragement in here for late blooming souls looking for a soulmate, and just my wish for all of you from my heart, from my soul, and definitely from the pages of this book is may everyone keep believing in themselves, may all soulmates meet, and may all of you keep listening to the truth of your soul. Thank you very much.
I was really interested in the dance, contra dancing.
Yeah.
Okay? So you're in Iowa.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm interested in your story about how you made a connection, you know, with it, or how did that happen?
It will actually happen in the book.
Oh, I see.
But I'll tell you how I did. I've been dancing since I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
It started with ballet. So, you know, I do speak through Katerina, so I gave her some of those qualities, even though all my characters are collages. And so I already, I did ballet, I did a lot of Israeli dancing, and before I moved to Iowa, I was just briefly introduced to contra dancing. It was something I hadn't done before. It was a new community. And, I was checking it out, the people there were checking me out, and when they found out I could dance, I was sort of embraced. And so when I got out to Iowa, where there's a spiritual community in Fairfield, Iowa, where John was also there for a while, and there was a little bit of contra dancing there, there was a little bit of English country dancing, which I hadn't done, but I learned how to do it because, you know, just a little bit of dancing is not enough if you love to dance. And then some of my friends started going. There are two characters here, Tom and George, who there's a George Mobile. It has a license plate that says from, and I mean to give you a little insight to him. They started going to dance weekends, and one of my friends actually met somebody out of state who had had a really hard time socially in Iowa and moved to Kentucky. So I fictionalized that in the book. So when I heard that, I asked Tom and George if I could go with them also. And they said, sure, you know, just get in the van. And there was a dance coming up, so I went to a dance. I guess it was probably in Chicago. And in Iowa, I was considered very odd, and I could go for 2 or 3 years with no one asking me on a date or having, like, no social life at all, which I felt was unacceptable and why I ultimately moved back. But I went there and met somebody really interesting, and then it was like, well, come, okay, so next dance weekend is the Knoxville dance, you know, Valentine's Day. Why don't you come to that? So I asked Tom and George, and they were already planning on going. So they included me in their plans, and then the one after that was Kim's Wick that was in Missouri, and then the one after that was in Kentucky, and so on. So that's how I got into it, and that's how my character got into it.
Thank you.
I guess in this area there's like NBCDS, North Bay Country Dance Society, BACDS, which is in San Francisco in the East and South Bay, Bay Area Country Dance Society. There's Circle Left and Queer Contra, which is gender free dancing, and there's a great community here. So, anything else?
Yeah, how did you, you touched on the yoga of the impossible. Can you describe either how, an example of how one might work with that, either with the character in the book or in your own life?
Okay, well, how I met it, there is no scripture. It's a totally oral tradition, and I heard about it from a friend in Iowa. You hear about everything in a town like Fairfield, Iowa. And it's the whole thing about, like, okay, so my friend John, who I heard about it, I mean, we're both, you know, we're going through very loving people with no relationship. We were, you know, we're buddies, and that kept me sane. But his thing was like, well, put yourself in an impossible situation and try to find your way out of it. Or if something's really kind of out of sync in the world with how you feel inside, start exploring that. It's kind of a path of intense introspection and kind of expecting, like a lot of people, like, okay, so like the self-help crowd, you know, they take a seminar, they learn a bunch of techniques, they want, you know, and they're working on a particular thing, so it's very kind of methodical and in a way controlling. And with yoga and the impossible, you just totally let go and expect whatever you're seeking for, whether it's knowledge or some sort of transformation in your life, it's expecting it to come out of left field when you least expect it. So it's kind of a pathless path in a way.
So it's a path of holding a receptivity,
yeah,
to whatever happens. Does that mean that then whatever experience you have, you embrace that as meaningful?
Oh, not necessarily. I mean, you could be like kicking and screaming while life is teaching you, but just sort of realizing that life is teaching you at the same time. So it's sort of a, you know, I've been exploring more and more about it, and as I was writing the book, I got in touch with the person who told me about it, and we've had lots of dialogues, and I have a couple of notes from conversations with him. Let me see if there's anything else that I want to mention. Okay. First of all, not running away, not despairing, kind of putting yourself into the center of the storm and without resisting the storm, so there's like the silence and there's the storm. It's a relentless path of self-examination, using the contradictions in your life as a way of finding the way out of them, which involves a huge letting go. As a philosophy, it's more a matter of introspection and discussion rather than authority. A lot of paths are very authority, and you must do this. And okay, so we're in Fairfield, Iowa, where there's all sorts of authority from the TM organization. It's like, no, this, my life is different than that, and I'm going to live it from the inside rather. Also, Yoga of the Impossible asks you to trust the universe and trust in God that somehow things will work out. As Krishna said to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, you have control over action alone, not over its results. And as a siddha, according to Patanjali, you have a desire and then let it go. So that's kind of a good way. It's kind of like knowing what's true, knowing what you want, but then letting go. And then again, what I said earlier is that if you have a spiritual practice that's just, you like your practice, but something about your life is not working, it's, you can sort of add this as a philosophy. And when you trust the universe and stop trying to control what you can't control, what you are longing for will come in an unexpected way, at an unexpected time, and from somewhere else. So part of it is just letting go of all control and just kind of embracing the storm. Is that helpful at all?
Yeah.
Or yeah?
Did you find any difference between the writing style when you were writing the younger version of Katerina and the older version? Was there a change in the voice when you were writing her, or did it kind of just all flow from that future state?
There's different voices at different states in her life.
Cool.
And because she starts out very young, you know, she comes of age in the first part, and, you know, there's a different, someone who's a teenager, someone in her young 20s is going to have a different voice than a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part is called My Year as a Dance Gypsy. It's actually a few years, but she's probably in her early 40s at that time. So, and she's had a lot of experience, and life hasn't brought her what she most desires. So she's, you know, it's kind of, she's spicy and she's vulnerable. There's a real intense vulnerability in that. And then the third part, My Yoga of the Impossible, I'm not going to give away the ending, but it's like, you know, there's that voice that comes after you just let go of everything that you thought life was going to be, like, what is it really? And, you know, maybe a little bit cynical, but still very, you know, open to the mystery. So, you know, because I think people get stronger as they get older, you know, things. I mean, you know, it's like when you're a teenager, you have the most incredible body and face you could ever imagine, but who would want to go back there and feel the way you did at that time? You know? So, these are wonderful questions.
In Blackberries in the Dream House,
yeah.
Your metaphor painting was a sound I loved so much. I just ate your metaphors. How do you cap the, I mean, did that just stream out of you, or?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good question. The process of writing is very mysterious even to me. I have a lot of training as a poet. I have 2 degrees. I teach poetry and fiction, you know, but I really, so my philosophy when writing Blackberries at the Dream House, in which my publisher held me to with this book, was that as much as possible, make every sentence beautiful.
It was.
So it's sort of, yeah. I have a few copies of that book over there too.
Every sentence.
I planted her.
No.
I mean, I'm very happy to meet you.
me too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful thing when this happens, because I write in silence and in isolation, and then I come here and meet people that have read my books, and it's just delicious. It's sort of, when I write, I'm in an altered state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like it's being downloaded in a way.
Mm.
It's, you know, just things come and it's real mysterious. I'm a nonlinear thinker. It doesn't come in order. You know, things just come and then But I know the hologram of the book, so I can kind of put it in order after it comes. But I let things emerge without controlling, and then I weave them in. But since I'm trained as a poet, I do the same thing with my sentences that I do with every line of a poem. Mm-hmm. You know, I want it to be powerful. I want it to be beautiful. I don't want any extra words. It's, you know, so I just really work the language. And Blackberries, well, that took me about 3 years to write. Yoga of the Impossible was about 10 and 20 drafts. After about 4 years, I thought I was done, so I told my publisher, I've got a new novel for you, I'll send it. And it was actually the morning before I was going to a dance weekend, I got a tough love email. It just said, I love your writing, I believe in you, but this book is not ready yet. So, and they said, I'll publish it when it's ready, but it is not. We met the standard of your first novel. You know, you hear the second novels are tough. Well, you know, and then he's holding me because Blackberry's got a Pulitzer nomination, so he's holding me to the same standard, and I really hadn't met it. So after I sent him an email and said, okay, tell me what your issues are, and I'll rewrite it with 4 test readers. So, and then about 2 hours later, I went off to this dance weekend and met my future husband. You know, so it was really so. One of my poetry students was in at the dance weekend too, dance gypsy. And when I told her, she was furious, and because she really loves my writing, and she said, "Well, I'll work with you. I'm a technical writer. Maybe, you know, we'll just work together." And then with Eric, you know, just met this wonderful guy, and everybody thinks we're married, and we just met each other, you know. Well, am I going to tell him about this? This is heavy. So, you know, the next morning I just had to tell him about it, and he immediately volunteered to be a test reader. Mm. And he's the best test reader you could imagine. Because I think that women authors need a male to run their main characters. My characters are collages of anywhere from 2 to 5 people, plus my imagination. But, you know, it's like when the car breaks down on the way to the Midwest. She was in her grandma's station wagon, which broke down in Nebraska after going to the Great Plains. It was based on, you know, I had a Subaru, so I didn't get the part right that would have blown it up and that sort of thing. And then there was another scene, like later in the book, when it's all sort of, there's a boy meets girl scene, and I showed it to Eric, and he said, you know, a man wouldn't say this. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, okay, what would a man say? And I'm starting to take notes, you know. And it's with Blackberries in the Dream House, I was mentored by a radio talk show host in Montreal and Toronto. I based 2 of the characters, both a good one and a bad one, on him, same person, but, you know, Jonathan and Richard are both this person. It was a wonderful person, but, you know, certain some things went down. When I wanted to run a male character, I would call up Alan and take notes, because I feel that men and women don't fundamentally understand each other. And same thing with male writers, you know, the woman's going to be one-dimensional unless it's based on a real woman. So I really wanted my men to be real men. You know, with the father, I would, like, you know, when my dad was alive, I'd call him up and take notes. I used his emails. That's so. Anything else?
Well, I'm kind of interested, and I'm glad you cleared it up when you said you were a late bloomer and hadn't found love, and now you're telling me that you did, at one of these dance, tantra dances, find the man that you married.
I did.
Could you say a little more about that?
Well, yeah. What do you... I mean...
How did you know? How did he know? How did you get together so quickly?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. How it happened, I had this really strong intuition that I wanted to go to this dance weekend called Monty Tayon. It's in the Redwood Forest in Aptos.
near Santa Cruz. And I was quite broke at the time. I was on the board of the Bay Area Country Dance Society. I knew the camp wasn't full. So I went to the organizers of the camp and said, I really want to go to this. I don't have enough money. Can we work something out? And they said, sure. Give us $150 and come on work crew. Fine. Eric, evidently, same situation. So he was on work crew. He was the first person who arrived. I was the second. There was a cello in the room. We're both cellists. It was a very distinctive cello. It has an alligator case, which I've never seen before or since. I had actually played that cello before he played it, before he moved out, and the person, I was trying it out, wondering if I was going to buy it, and decided no. And then he said, you know, I need to take it back. This guy is coming out who's a cellist. So, and we'd heard of each other, but he had came out to chase someone, and it didn't work out, you know. I was in a long-distance relationship with a dance gypsy. I was pretty it just had a chance to get deeper, and it didn't. So we were both exiting and healing from other relationships. We were too tired to do anything except be ourselves. But, you know, it's like after we set up the dance hall, with lots of lights and, you know, and all sorts of things. And then, since it has really good resonance, he took out the cello and started playing, and oh my God. So, you know, it was definitely love at first sight. And then, you know, I knew who he had come up to chase, and I asked him if she was coming to the dance weekend, and he said, I wouldn't know. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. And we started talking, and we were just pouring our hearts out to each other, and we were also very comfortable with each other, and it just felt like it didn't feel like we'd just met. And a lot of people that night and that weekend asked us if we were married. And the guy calling the dance said, well, we told him, hey, wait a minute, we just met, but we knew there was a really strong connection. And he said, you just remember, I was there when. So about 3 years ago, he came out to call a dance, and we went and told him he was right, and he took pictures with us and stuff. But, you know, before that, I'd found relationships impossible and difficult, and I would just be myself, and it didn't work. And with Eric, I'm just myself, and it works, and we don't have to try. And, you know, nobody's perfect, but that's okay. There's so much good, and
the cello was a big sign.
Well, we play together in the Golden Gate Symphony. He's a very gifted cellist. He was a child prodigy. I'm an adult student of music. I have a larger gift with language, but, you know, I study with a symphony player, and I practice, and so I work and I get there. And he's shared things about playing the cello that I wouldn't have even known to ask. Because he's got perfect pitch, he's got very subtle, you know, idea, knowledge of sound, and I've learned to listen to things I wouldn't have heard otherwise.
Great, thank you.
So, anyway, there's a message in this book that no matter what your age is, if you feel like you have a soulmate, don't give up. I really want to thank you. This is just so wonderful spending the evening with you. I'm happy to sign books if any of you want to take it home and read more of the rest of the story or any of my other books. And
thank you.
Thank you all.
So many of you know the drill here. We're a nonprofit church operated bookstore, so we have a donation bowl over there. I encourage you to contribute to it. We share donate with our speakers to further their work and retain half to maintain these events in the future for future occasions. And of course, I'll point out in addition to Yoga of the Impossible, we have four other titles, it looks like here, including this book we heard has been so beautifully received at the national level, and God, it's another great cover. So what can I say? Please do check these out anyway, and thank you all for coming to Many Rivers Books and Tea tonight. Look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah.